I would suggest we can sum up what Exodus tells us in these chapters around where we read. It's a story of deliverance through judgment. Israel delivered, Egypt under judgment. If we go back a little, we have looked at Moses being prepared for a great work, although perhaps it hardly seemed to be a preparation for it at the outset. Things were certainly not going well to begin with. But it's a remarkable story that the Lord was working in this man's life in order to prepare him for what he needed to do. But the people of Israel were also being prepared for something remarkable. They were under oppression and with a great desire for freedom. They were not a slave people. They had known freedom. But now they were enslaved, they were oppressed, and they had a longing to be released. It was with this in mind and this cry that they sent out somewhere, their agony, their groaning. It was with this that Moses was then called by God. He was called in order to do this great work, to lead God's people out of Egypt. And as you might recall, he received that call under great protest until every possible escape route was cut off. But he was to lead God's people out of Egypt in the sense that he was the one to whom God would speak in order to speak for God, and that he would direct the people. And the consequence that we find is at the end of chapter 4, that section that we were looking at, so the people believed. They heard God's word through Moses and Aaron, his brother, and they believed, and they worshipped the Lord. And that's where we were able to go so far. And to take it on from there, and as I think I said quite a number of weeks ago, I'm not intending to cover every single event that has unfolded in Israel's history, but there are certain parts that are crucial, and so to work through them. Moving on from there, Moses then did as he was commissioned by the Lord, and took his brother Aaron with him to speak to the king. Now this was the king Pharaoh. Remember, Moses had to flee for his life because he had killed an Egyptian. And it tells us that that particular Pharaoh died, and there was another one in his place. So it is quite possible that this particular Pharaoh might have been a brother or an uncle, in a sense, as Moses himself had grown up as the grandson of the previous Pharaoh. So when Moses went with his true brother Aaron to this king, had they met before? It is a question mark, it is a speculation perhaps, but it might just be worth our while realizing that this is a potential issue for Moses, that he might well have recognized the Pharaoh who was there. The Pharaoh might well have recognized him. But for all that, remember too that Moses was familiar with this kind of environment that he was going into. Now Moses and Aaron, along with the people that they had left behind, they had just spoken to, knowing that Moses was going to the king, there is a suggestion in the way that the story is told that there were hopes of, if not quite an immediate, but a very quick response, a positive response at that, that they were hopeful that the king, when approached in this way, would say, "All right then, I will let you go." But that's far from what happened. We find in chapter 5 that Pharaoh said, not just not this time or not till next month or anything of that nature. He rather quite brashly showed his obstinate nature, and he said, "Who is the Lord that I should listen to him?" This was an introduction. After all, Moses had to be introduced to the Lord himself not long before. So in some ways, Pharaoh might be seen, in this world's eyes at least, to be within his rights. But that's what he said. He wasn't going with this at all. In fact, the results were even worse. And so I've suggested, you might say, to begin with, humanly speaking, it was a failure, the first appeal of Moses to the king of Egypt. There were results, immediate results, but quite the opposite of what they were looking for. Instead of release, the bondage and the oppression just got worse. Pharaoh, rather sharply, shrewdly, says to himself, "Well, if these people think that they can, they need to get away and spend 3 days worshipping God, then they're not doing enough. Let's make things heavier for them." Now, I've gone through all this because it leads us to the point where we took up our reading, because the result was that the elders, representatives of the people of Israel, met Moses as he came out of the palace and said, "Look what you've done now. All this bright idea of going to speak to the king and ask for release, look what it's done to us. It's just made things worse. All the people are in terrible pain as a result." And almost the question, what are all these fine words worth now? That was there in the section just before we started reading. The complaint of the people leveled against Moses and upon the Lord himself. And Moses himself takes this up. Moses sees this as a failure. As we read in verse 23 of chapter 5, "Since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all." This was the very idea that the Lord had promised to them. "I will deliver your people. Look what you've done, Lord. It's just got worse. You haven't delivered. I don't understand what's going on." So in the first place, we find things getting worse, we find a failure, in a sense, of this approach for Israel to be released from Egypt. But then we see God's answer. And I think God's answer indicates that what's going on here is to bring Israel to an even more helpless situation. To be, if you like, more aware of their helplessness. That it was utterly hopeless for them by this time. Not only was their work harder, they were being treated far worse as well. Completely helpless, completely bound, in an extreme condition. And the Lord said to Moses in chapter 6, verse 1, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. That he will use a strong hand, not just to let the people go, but to drive them out." God is going to do his work. This is working as he intends it to work. But you have to be helpless first. "Now you will see God's mighty hand." And this is to remind them, and this is to be in their recollection constantly, as I think Psalm 105 indicates it was for some people. To show that all of this, that deliverance, it was to be of God. It is a deliverance. It's not an escape in the usual sense of the word. It's not their work to get out of the land. It's that God came and worked upon them and around them and delivered them. They had to learn that. They had to learn that it was to be grace all the way. And I emphasize this because it's a vitally important lesson that I think Israel had to learn from this point onwards, right through their history. And it's pointing right through their history as well to Jesus himself and Jesus' work. There are so many ways in this in which this whole story of the Exodus is to be recognized as a picture of the release from the bondage of sin. Man has to see, in relation to the sin in his life that binds him, has to see that he is hopeless. He cannot achieve anything himself. And sometimes the way, when man tries it, it just binds him all the more. Man has to learn, as Israel did then, that the deliverance comes by God's grace entirely. It's not of me, not of Israel, but God and his grace. But in the course of talking to Moses here in his response, after that apparent failure, you find what I think are some of the most remarkable words in all of Scripture. In verses 2 through to 8. Chapter 6, verses 2 to 8. We read them. These are bound together, first of all, by verses 2, what God said there, down to the end of verse 8. Beginning and end, God says, I am the Lord. That's to be the foundation of all of this. And the important thing there is that, as he says in verse 3, this is his covenant name. I am this person. I am this person who has entered into covenant with your forefathers, with all those promises, and with you. This is who I am. This is who's speaking. Get this right, first of all. I am the Lord. Not to be confused with the Lord in the sense of the Supreme One, the Great Master, that type of thing. There is something of that in this whole passage, that he is the dominant one, he is the sovereign, he is supreme. But it's especially his covenant relationship which he's concerned to bring out here. And the covenant reiteration or renewal. I am the Lord, beginning and end, 2 and 8. And he is telling Moses here, telling us that he had a clear purpose all along. He's setting out what his purpose is. And it's what? 7 verses? That's not a great deal in relation to what is going to happen. Very succinct, very much to the point. What is the point? He says, I have dealt with your forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I have established my covenant with them. What is that covenant? To give them the land of Canaan. To give them the land. They're not in the land at the moment, but I have covenanted to give it to them. And he says in verse 5, I have also heard the groaning of the children of Israel and have remembered my covenant. Therefore, verse 6, say to the children of Israel, and here especially, these remarkable words, I am the Lord again, in verse 6, down to verse 8. And in these three verses, 6 through 7 and 8, you have God saying 7 times, I will do something. He's not asking what they're going to do. He says, I will do this. 7 times. I will bring you out from under the burdens. I will rescue you from their bondage. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great judgments. And once he's done that, what happens next? I will take you as my people. I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And then again in verse 8, not only is he going to bring them out, he doesn't just bring them out and leave them to find their own way. In verse 8 he says, and I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to them, and I will give it to you as a heritage. From beginning to end, from release to security and heritage, God is going to do everything. In those three verses, I am the Lord. Don't make any mistake about it. I will bring you out of here and take you in there. This is the course of it. And in the middle of all of that is this most remarkable statement, the two pairs put together, I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. This is what holds the whole thing together. I am the Lord, I will be your God. This wonderful covenant statement. And this is to be the foundation of all that God is doing with Israel at that point, and indeed it will be from there on as well. The covenant is renewed, reiterated, restated, I suggest, in a remarkable way in those few words. And so, in verse 9, Moses spoke this way to the children of Israel, but they would not heed him because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. That, too, I think, is a picture of sin. The Paul writes and says, it was when we were dead in our trespasses and sins. We were under cruel bondage so that we couldn't hear, we couldn't do a thing. Under that cruel bondage, they wouldn't heed Moses and these wonderful promises. It's when we were dead in trespasses and sins that Christ died for us. And so it is God who goes on doing the mighty works. And he explains, too, more about what he is setting out to do. He goes on to tell of what his plans are in terms of action, but also of his purpose. He's setting out to make himself known to Egypt, and through them to others as well. But he is to be seen by them as the great and the mighty one. He is going to bring them out, the people out. I am jumping over the passage where it gives some of the sons and names and so on. It is the names of the different tribes in part of chapter 6. They're still there. It includes Moses' own family in more detail as well. Now, I'm taking you on to chapter 7. There the Lord said to Moses, I have made you as God to Pharaoh. You're going to be telling Pharaoh what's going to happen, or you're going to tell him through your brother who will be your prophet. You will speak all these things so that Pharaoh must send the children of Israel out of his land. And it's from here on that we start to see the great signs, the great works that God is going to do, or was doing in Egypt. And all of this he describes in the first part of chapter 7. While it tells us that Pharaoh will not heed them, it does say that this would be done by great judgments in verse 4 and verse 5, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. This is what it's all about, to show them that he is God. He is the one of power and might. What are the plagues about? I'm not going to go into them in detail. There is a handy little list that's been provided for you of the various places where they appear. But it's about wearing Egypt down and demonstrating God's power. Egypt needed to know who he was. In fact, some have traced all of the 10 different events to different deities of Egypt, saying this one would be represented by such and such a thing, say the frogs and where they've come from. And if that's the case, then it's God showing very clearly that he's greater than any of them. We actually read that he says it's the gods of Egypt that are being defeated. Some might ask, well, these are awful things. There are 10 of them. Why did they go on for so long? Why so many? Again, it's been calculated that probably all of these 10 plagues could be reckoned to have happened within a period of about 6 months. Many people have looked at them and they've said, well, this one can be explained in this way, and that one can be explained in that way, and so on. But for all the scientific explanations, no one can answer why they happened as they happened, in this order, in this way, with Moses able to tell precisely what was going to happen and when beforehand. This is God's work. And perhaps we come to the number 10 because it's a sign of completeness. It was indeed a complete work by the time number 10 came. And a large part of this whole issue centers on Pharaoh's response. And this is quite another remarkable part of this whole story. Initially, in the first couple of cases with the great signs, Pharaoh's magicians were able to do exactly the same thing. So Pharaoh could say, well, it's no big deal. But the time soon came when even his advisors said, this is God's work, this is God's hand. As Moses put to him, there is no one like the Lord, our God. And when the magicians and the wise men of Egypt began to say this, Pharaoh promised the release. He said to Moses on each occasion, he said, if you ask God to take this away, then I will let your people go. And then we find it repeatedly. When the plague was taken away, Pharaoh saw that there was relief. And I just take one example in chapter 8, verse 15. When he saw that there was relief, he hardened his heart and did not heed them, as the Lord had said. Repeatedly, all the way through, from chapter 7, verse 13, verse 14, verse 22, chapter 8, verse 15, verse 19, verse 32, chapter 9, verse 7, chapter 9, verse 12. We're only halfway through the plagues, but we need to stop for a moment. Pharaoh was hardening his heart to that point. And there, chapter 9, verse 12, we see the way that the story is changing. The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. Halfway through, five plagues, Pharaoh had shown his stubbornness. He had hardened his own heart. He had refused to change. And then the Lord hardens his heart, as the Lord had said he would do back in chapter 7, in verse 3. I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. Now I mention this because it is often felt to be a difficult thing. Why should Egypt be punished if the Lord is hardening Pharaoh's heart? But the Lord will not go on forever trying to persuade a man against his will. Pharaoh had constantly hardened his heart. He'd set himself against God so much that perhaps in a sense we could look at it that the Lord had no intention now of doing anything to soften that heart. All that God would do thereafter, where to some, to the believer, it might be, as Paul describes it, a scent, a savor of life. But to someone who has hardened his heart, it becomes a scent of death. In itself, it brings death. It does the hardening because he's hardened his heart in the first place. It was Pharaoh who brought judgment. He could have answered positively the first time, but he didn't. He brought judgment that was heavier and heavier and heavier on his own land and his own people. He just would not listen or respond. This, by the way, there is no secular record of the plagues in Egypt's otherwise immaculate records and history. But it seems like one section is blotted out because it just was such a disaster for the land and the king. And he would not listen until the firstborn came under threat. Even then, when the threat, it was just the threat upon the firstborn, he wouldn't listen. He wouldn't say, right, now's the time to get out and to clean the position, get the people out. The threat was there in the first place. It was well set out, clearly set out in chapter 11, where we read. The firstborn was of great cultural significance in those days, but we find that it became something of special significance to the Lord as well. But look again how completely certain God is as he tells of this. He is utterly in control of all that's happening. Is there to be any escape from this? Chapter 11, verse 9 says that Pharaoh will not heed you, even now, so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. Again, driving this point home, who the Lord is. And the Lord who was then to take his people out and to take them on into the land. That other people knew of this as well. Lord, bless and pity us, that the earth thy way and nations all may know by saving grace. So the firstborn came under threat, the tenth of the plague. But within this setting too, we have the Passover appears. Its announcement is made in chapter 12. Again, we read part of that, with all the directions and the explanation about it. Look how, for example, it starts, this month shall be your beginning of months. This was to be recognized as the beginning of the nation. Your life starts from here onwards almost. And then comes the lamb and the blood, and a fire that burns, that cooks the lamb. Fire speaking of purity as well. And the readiness to be dressed, ready to go. 9 times so far the people have been promised they would be able to leave. But it's this time that they are to be ready to leave. Made ready. Why now? Because this was to be the climax of the work. And it seems that the people were ready to respond. Something in all of this so far had changed something for Israel. In fact, halfway through, the plagues were only happening on Egypt. Where Israel lived, they weren't happening. There was a distinction, very clear. And now the people were ready. And there were some Egyptians who went with them. A mixed multitude, tells you in chapter 12, 38. Some Egyptians had recognized that God was with his people. They wanted to go with him as well. So there were these things they were told to do with the threat against the firstborn. Some of it might have seemed strange. To paint blood on the posts of your door, it's an unusual thing. But the ones who did it showed that they trusted in God, in his instruction, in his word. Exercise of faith. Don't let anyone ever tell you that there isn't faith and grace as the hope of man in the Old Testament. It's all there. These people, the sign it wasn't able to save in its own right. They couldn't save themselves in any other way. It was all through faith that this was the way that God had set out for them. Do this and you will be saved. The other thing about the Passover is that from the very beginning they were told that this must be a future observance as well. We just read the first part of that in verse 14 of chapter 12. It was to be a commemoration of great deliverance. Once a year, right through, we find it to the day of the Lord Jesus, as he too ate the Passover to remember the deliverance of the nation. And aren't there such clear signs of him? And the lamb, and the blood, the lamb that was to die in the place of the firstborn. Substitution is there right at the beginning of the nation. Or else God's judgment would fall upon that house as well. And so then the story tells us of the fulfillment. Things happened exactly as they were told. Just in a few verses it tells us in chapter 12, 29, it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. It happened just as he said it would happen. It was fulfilled. And so came the Exodus, the actual Exodus. It tells us that the people were then, Moses was called by Pharaoh, and he did drive them out. He said, go, take everything you have, go, get out of here. The people asked their neighbors for whatever they could give them, and they took great numbers. They plundered the Egyptians, we're told in verse 36 of chapter 12. I wonder if anyone remembers back in Genesis 15, the things that were promised to Abraham. Back there, promised to Abraham, was that they would become a great nation. In verse 37, it tells us that there were about 600,000 men on foot. So there were women and children. On top of that, the reckoning is that with 600,000 men, and presumably of fighting age, you're looking at about 2 million people. A great nation. That's what they had gone for in the first place, was that they would have the opportunity to grow. But in Genesis 15, they were told that, or Abraham was told that they would be in a strange land for 400 years. Maybe an approximate figure, as we often do. Well, several hundred years, perhaps, we would say. 400 years. 430 years to the day, we're told in this same chapter, in verses 14:41. And they were told, Abraham was told, that they would plunder this strange nation, the Egyptians, which is exactly what they did as well, 12:36. Promises of the covenant to Abraham were fulfilled so far. And so what did they do? The people took it up. I should really have put in the chapter 13 as well. The story is only complete of the Exodus to this point. They took the bones of Joseph with them. Joseph had said in faith, take my bones with you into the land. That's what they did in 13:19. In chapter 13, we're also told that God said, because of what's happened, because the firstborn was saved, they're consecrated to me. Set them apart. Redeem them. Something had to be sacrificed for each firstborn child, or else their life was forfeit. To remember the deliverance of God, of the people by God from Egypt. And then within the Exodus, there were also the precautions that God took. One in particular, where there was a common way to travel from Egypt, run by the coast. If you picture the Mediterranean coast, they would travel, eastward, and then they would go around the coast. But that's where the Philistines lived. That's where other warlike people lived. And they were not ready for war. They'd just come out of hard slavery. Lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt, the Lord sent them on a different direction. Again, God's care over them, that they shouldn't return to bondage. Not an easy direction. Not the easiest, the most difficult. But in order to preserve them and take them into the land that he had promised. So that's to try and just take the main threads of this story through. There are just a couple of conclusions to just tie it in, the key points out of it all. And the first is what I've described the whole section dealing with, salvation by judgment. Let's never forget this, that this is God's way of working. And both sides, the salvation and the judgment, we often see them as not belonging together, but both of them are dealing with evil and injustice. It's clearest in the night of that tenth plague. Through the judgment. But as they took his God's instruction by faith and obedience, they came under his protection while the judgment was exercised upon those who did not believe. Salvation came out of it for the people. Faith, trusting in God's provided and stipulated substitute. If they'd chosen something else, it wouldn't have done any good. It wasn't any use. They had to go as God said. And as far as God was concerned, the judgment had to come. What was better about Israel than Egypt? Nothing intrinsically. Something or someone had to die, even then. And this is one of the great beauties of it too, of course, is that death also gave them food for the journey. That's food for thought that you can take with you. And so salvation comes with judgment. It was by God's mighty works on Egypt that he was going to bring his people out. He'd said it several times himself. And then there was the Exodus. Redemption from bondage. He uses the word redeem. I'm going to redeem you. This was to begin the nation, set it out as an independent nation. And this Exodus, this redemption, was to serve for that nation as a persistent background to all of that God dealt with Israel from here on. Several times the prophets refer back to it. How are these people going to live in the future? They are now free men. Would they live as free men? Would they live as free in the presence of this covenant God? So often they failed. They turned away. They went back to other gods, no better than Egypt's gods. How would they live? And that's why they had this perpetual observance of the Passover. Every year they were to remember, at the beginning of the year, they were to remember how God had delivered them. What for? To be his people. And for him to be their God. But year by year it was forgotten. And in fact, one of the kings tells us about him that the Passover had not been celebrated in that way for years and years beforehand. They'd neglected even that. But that's much further on in the story. That's why God said it here, that they would continue to serve him and live with him. This promise of a great nation, this part two, was now fulfilled. Abraham had a promise. You will have a seed, a son, Isaac. Out of that seed there will be a great nation. It was now come into fulfillment, although it was going to get even greater. And the next part of it, this land will be yours, that was coming into fulfillment too, through the nation. There was only one part left. But in that nation, in the seed of Abraham, would all the nations of the earth be blessed as well. So this story of Exodus, this most remarkable event, the way that God did it, the supremacy of God's grace in Israel's experience, is pointing us even there to the Lord Jesus Christ, the fulfillment of the whole covenant. I will be their God. I will be with them. They will be my people. May God bless his word again to us this evening.